Good afternoon, Katie and Kay listeners. The time is 4 o'clock. I'm Marilyn Gleason. It's time for our Valley Voices program, where we bring you voices from the Valley every couple of weeks here on Katie and Kay. Today, my guest is Delia Malone. She is the co-chair of the Roaring Fork Audubon, the wildlife chair for the Colorado Sierra Club, and she is a recently retired, I guess, ecologist for the Colorado Natural Heritage Program. And we're going to be talking about, I don't know, the natural heritage, the birds, the bees, the bears, all those great creatures out there. So welcome, Delia.
Thank you, Marilyn. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, always a pleasure for me to have you here in the studio. Well, I just attended an event a week before Saturday that you put together, bringing some folks down from Idaho who have a lot of experience with wolves to talk to all of us, people like me and others, and also to some of the ranchers in our area about their experience. Carter Niemeyer was there. He's worked with wolves for the government for decades and has written some really great books about his experiences doing that. So I was really attracted by that, having read his book, Wolfland. He's got a new book out, and there were some other folks too. Glenn Elzinga, Suzanne Asia Stone, those were the people I saw down here in Carbondale at the Third Street Center. Tell me a little bit about why you put this event together in the first place.
We put the event together, Marilyn, because we know that, number one, there are recent conflicts between wolves and livestock in the valley. We also know that those conflicts don't have to happen. We know from the experience from folks like Glenn Elzinga and Suzanne Asia Stone and Carter Niemeyer that there are fairly straightforward, not rocket science, strategies. Yes, they're different. Different methods requires change that can prevent livestock conflict with wolves. And so there seems to have been a lack of information. There seems to have been a lack of education, learning, experience from CPW. And so we undertook to bring the folks that do it, that prevent conflict between livestock and wolves, here to the valley in the hopes that we can stop that. We can go forward with a progressive program that enables livestock to thrive and wolves to survive.
And Delia, what are they doing in Idaho that we are not here in Colorado?
Boy, that's a big question, Marilyn, but in 30 seconds or less. With regard to cattle, probably the most important strategy is human presence. Wolves are afraid of us. They don't want to be anywhere near us. And so the technological term is range riders. So having a range rider with your cattle, range rider one or two, with your cattle, can prevent wolves from coming into the herd. So the example from Glenn Elzinga up in Idaho, he runs about, 350 or 400 cow-calf pairs. And his two daughters and a couple of others manage those herds. They manage them, they keep them together, they move them through the range. They prevent the conflict. And a side benefit of having the range riders when they're properly trained is that they keep the cattle moving slowly so that they're constantly eating, putting on weight, which translates into dollars. And in addition, they prevent conflict between wolves and livestock. So Glenn, in the last 12 years that he's adopted these kind of non-lethal coexistence methods, he has lost no cattle to wolf predation. Yeah. Similarly, Suzanne Asia Stone runs the Wood River Wolf Project. She runs sheep and about 20,000 sheep in several different herds. And over the last 18 years, which her project has been going on for, they lose an average of 4 to 5 sheep to wolves. This last 3 years, they've finally gotten it right. They've lost no sheep to wolves. So that's pretty impressive. And the idea is that we bring those, they've already learned how to do this. They've spent, you know, a decade and a half, almost 2 decades figuring this out. Instead of us having to reinvent and relearn, bringing that information to our valley was really important for us.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I totally am on board with the idea of learning from other people's experience and letting them, you know, go through the hard process of learning these things. And I mean, we do have these people who have already been through this. It was interesting that some of Suzanne Asha Stone's neighbors are getting much higher rates of predation than she is. And I was just really fascinating listening to Glenn Elzinga talk about the way that they're taking care of their cattle, just really going back to the old way, the old ways of the cowboys. I mean, they're out there on the range in the Frank Church, you know, national forest or wilderness area, like living with their cattle.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of, he's kind of in a great position because he has 7 girls. And as he mentioned,
daughters,
he mentioned he put them on a horse like right when they were 2 years old or something. And so they have become his best riders. But he also has this really kind of unique program where college age kids apply to be interns. And so he has kind of this ready-made range rider program. They go out for a couple weeks at a time. He feeds them, but he doesn't really pay them anything, and they are clamoring for the opportunity to be range riders.
To just live out there on the range. And, you know, there it ties into a trend that I've seen where the younger generation really is becoming interested again in agriculture.
They are, and I guess I really want to highlight a couple of benefits. Yes, it's hard work. What he's seen is a dramatic increase in weight being put on his cattle, which translates into, you know, economic benefit. A couple of other important benefits is what they've documented is that the grass and the forbs, the flowering plants on the range have improved dramatically, which translates into better forage for his cattle, which makes them healthier. Additionally, because there's range riders there, they keep them out of the riparian wetlands.
And riverbanks.
Riverbanks, thank you. Mm-hmm. And they've seen beaver come back because the vegetation has come back, and the streams are now clean enough to drink out of.
Mm. And when you have a lot of cattle around streams, typically those streams are pretty muddy and fouled.
Yeah, and what happens, of course, is if the vegetation can recover, the vegetation sort of filters out pollutants from cattle that might flow into the stream. And in combination with beavers and their dams, those dams allow the water to slow down and pollutants to filter out. So the combination of those two things has really benefited the entire ecosystem of the range.
And they sort of have these animals trained to, well, I guess the cattle, they just hold them closer together and they're not letting them spread out over long distances. And he talked about times when the wolves would be right up the hill barking and howling. And because the cattle are all clustered together and there's people there too, they're kept safe. And the sheep also are basically trained to come down to a specific area at nighttime.
So same concept. There's a herder and there's guardian dogs. And to be clear, the guardian dogs are not to fight wolves. They are to warn the herders that there is a predator nearby. And then it's the job of the herder to go out there. And again, wolves are afraid of us. They don't want to have anything to do with us. They know that we're dangerous. And so when there's people around, wolves stay away. And, you know, as Glenn said, and as Carter even described, you know, wolves, when they see us, they make it for the next valley. In this, and I want to bring up a really important point, in this valley, we've got the Copper Creek wolf family. And what the initial experiences of that Copper Creek wolf family resulted in is getting used to eating beef. And that happened because the first place that they were in over in Grand County, the rancher there did not cover up his carcass pit. Mm-hmm. That was the first time that those wolves had ever been exposed to beef. When they were moved, when they were taken into captivity and kept in an enclosure pen for a couple of months and then moved here, they did predate a couple of calves. What should have happened is there should have been what's called non-injurious hazing to make wolves afraid of us.
Is that kind of like joining a frat?
Ha ha. Well, I've never been in a frat or a sorority. But hazing, yeah, I would get that's sort of like that. So hazing, just shooting beanbags at the wolf, it hurts. And when that happens, they understand that we are not their friend, that we're dangerous. So we don't have to kill them. Mm-hmm. We can use non-lethal methods to prevent conflict.
Well, I was going to ask you about this, Delia, because it's something I haven't heard talked about much in the news. I learned it from another person who has worked with the wolf task forces, or the wolf task force, that about this carcass pile that was there where these wolves were released in these Grand County ranches that then became so problematic. How did this happen? I mean, tell me, you know, this seems like one of those things that should not have happened.
It should not have happened. There is no requirement for a producer to cover their carcass pit. It is certainly way up on the list of recommendations to prevent conflict. So the idea is that a carcass pit is like an easy meal. The wolves can go there. They don't have to fight.
And this is where a rancher disposes of his cattle that have died for one reason or another.
So cattle die often from things like poisoning. They eat the wrong plants. They die from getting tangled up into barbed wire. They'll fall in a ditch. And so those cows are drug off and they're put in his carcass pit. Covering that carcass pit to prevent predators, whether it be cougars or bears or wolves, from getting into that carcass pit prevents predators from getting acclimated to humans and also encourages them to seek natural prey like elk and deer. This rancher did not do that. In fact, we obtained through CORA, Colorado Open Records Act, the documentation that he actually was asked by CPW to close that carcass pit and he refused. Mm-hmm. Well, in the interim, we have a single male wolf with mom in the den with pups, and he's trying to feed his family. And we find out later that he had been shot, and so one of his legs was injured, which further debilitated him, which, boy, it's an easy thing to go into the carcass pit to get some scraps, easier than trying to take down an elk, which probably had been driven off by the cattle in the pasture. And so he got acclimated to that, to beef, because of that rancher. And he ended up dying, and the Copper Creek pack was captured. They were relocated over here. What should have happened is that the ranchers should have been notified that there were wolves in the area. They were not. And there should have been non-injurious hazing used to remind those wolves that humans and livestock are dangerous. None of that was done.
Mm. It's really a heart-wringing story about, you know, the wolf family, I mean, and their side just trying to survive and getting trained on these carcasses. Since that time, some big payouts have gone from the state of Colorado to these very same ranchers that had problems with these wolves and maybe caused the problems with the wolves to some extent in Grand County.
So the biggest payout was due to what the rancher purports were weight loss and decrease in calving. there, according to Cora records, there is a little firm documentation that that actually occurred. But the management plan right now in place does say that ranchers should be compensated if they can document those losses.
And we do need that kind of, I mean, that was an important part of doing this reintroduction, was getting ranchers on board too, knowing that they weren't going to be harmed in the end, but hundreds of thousands of dollars went out.
For the weight loss and production loss, payment was $267,000. That was not for predation. That was for so-called production losses. It's important to note that Colorado has probably the most generous payment for losses of any state in the United States. And recently, we got up to the $1 million mark from the revenue from the Born to Be Wild license plate. And that is a voluntary people who want to help with the wolf conflict prevention. They can buy the Born to Be Wild license plate, and all of the revenue from the sale of that license plate goes to Colorado Parks and Wildlife specifically for non-lethal coexistence methods. The hallmark just last week was that $1 million have been raised. So all of that money will go to help ranchers fund non-lethal coexistence methods.
Okay, so there is money there. I'm talking to Delia Malone. She's the co-chair of our own Roaring Fork Audubon, the wildlife chair for the Colorado Sierra Club, and she was the person who put together this great event we had weekend before last to learn a little more about wolves and coexisting with wolves. I talked to Matt Barnes, who was the person on the task forces, and he told me how he had lost a lot of political capital by really pushing, by being the dissenter in a consensus group, asking, pushing for pay for presence instead of the kind of program that we have now, which we were just talking about, where all of these dollars are going out to ranchers who have lost cattle. Instead, paying ranchers who are successfully coexisting with wolves on their property.
You know, I'm going to say that really key to coexisting using non-lethal tools is being proactive. In other words, before there's a conflict, you need to know that the wolf is there, and right there has been a real issue, because most of the ranchers don't know until it's too late that there is a wolf on their property. And I'm going to lose some political capital probably, and what I'm going to say is that I think the ranchers should know if there's a wolf around. That way they can take appropriate proactive action. Right now the policy is that only CPW knows.
Yeah, and CPW has really held their cards close to their chest throughout this process. What do you think that's all about?
That's a big question, Marilyn. And, you know, there are some, they probably have some legitimate reasons. So, for instance, a reason that is often given for not giving ranchers the information ahead of time is that they may use that to go out and harm wolves. There is some reason for thinking that. That's happened often down in Arizona and New Mexico with Mexican gray wolves. My own position is that, at least in this valley, I think our ranchers deserve to be trusted with that information, because only with that information can they be proactive and implement non-lethal tools ahead of time to prevent the conflict. The other option to that is that CPW have a robust presence here, and they are on it before it happens, not days afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so there is, CPW, I'm sure, has some reasons for doing what they do. I will say that some of them, in my opinion, are not founded in the experience, for instance, from folks like Carter Niemeyer or Suzanne Asha Stone or Glenn Elzinga. So I don't know that they have taken advantage of the experience from all these people that they could have.
Well, it does seem like a situation where we really would want to learn from the people who have already been through this, and to the extent that we can't go through all the same belly aches that they did in the Northern Rockies in this reintroduction, we should certainly take advantage of that. You also had some daytime events that were workshops for ranchers. One was at Rock Bottom Ranch. Were there two of those?
No, there was just one at Rock Bottom Ranch. And then on the following day, on Sunday, there was actually a demonstration event out at Kaufman Ranch.
Okay. How did all that go?
I think it went really well. I think the demonstration project was really very useful. So one of Suzanne's field techs from Idaho also came, Ava. And Ava is out there with the sheep and with the herders doing that, you know, throughout the season. She came and she brought flattery, which is basically fluttering tape, fluttering red flags that is on an electric wire that frightens wolves and keeps them away. So the idea is that at night you bring your sheep or your cattle together into a penned area. And nighttime, so wolves are crepuscular. They typically hunt late in the afternoon, early evening, or they hunt first thing in the morning. During the day, they're typically hanging out under a tree when it's hot. So at night is when you have to be really vigilant. And so bringing your cattle and sheep into a confined area at night, putting the flattery or whatever it is around the penned area, and you can have your tent, the herder or the range rider can have their tent nearby, and if there's livestock guardian dogs, they will bark, they will alert the range rider or herder that there's wolves in the area, and that's how you, one important strategy to preventing loss.
I understand a lot of ranchers showed up to this workshop.
I wish there were more, but there were some really important, they're all important, ranchers in the area. And I think I need to say that I really appreciate and thank these ranchers for continuing to try and work to prevent conflict and not just giving it in and shooting at wolves.
Okay. We can move on to birds. It's migration season. And it's always nice to talk to somebody from the Audubon about birds. We just really have a few minutes, but 1.2 billion birds were seen migrating at night with radar equipment on September 25th, which was a record, but this isn't very old technology. But a lot of birds in the sky on one particular night because they know when all of the elements are in place for them to do their long migration flight. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the app that tracks these birds and how we're watching these birds at night now.
Well, really, it's through radar that is seeing kind of what they see and what they originally thought. They didn't know what it was, what they originally thought. Airplane people that are in air towers were seeing ghosts, and they thought, oh my goodness, there really is angels out there. Okay. And what they discovered is that the radar was picking up these clouds, and the clouds were just millions of birds migrating together. Songbirds, particularly about 80% of our birds, migrate at night, typically around midnight. They're using the stars, they're using gravity, they're using a number of different strategies to figure out where to go. Typically, at around midnight, the winds are the calmest, so they have the least amount of wind to push back against. They can navigate by the stars. They typically like a wind out of the north to migrate south, and a wind out of the south in the spring to migrate back north. Important to know, I think it's really critical, that birds, most birds, not all, but most of these birds don't make their migration flight in one large one-way. flight. They need to stop on the way. So they have these migratory stopover sites. And those sites, they may stay for just a couple of days. And they are refueling, they're regaining fat, they're resting, and then they're back on their way. So these migratory stopover sites are just as important for birds' survivability as is their breeding habitat up in the north and their wintering habitat down in the south.
Do we have some of those stopover sites here in Colorado?
I would say, well, yes, absolutely. And birds typically are, when they're migrating, they follow a route that they've followed for thousands of years. So these aren't random flights. These are flights that are in their genetic memory that have evolved over the eons, over thousands of years, as the continents moved into position, as climate developed, the birds learned along the way, and then they pass on that knowledge to their offspring. So they like to follow, for instance, river corridors. So North Star Nature Preserve up east of Aspen, the various reservoirs around here up in Spring Park, critical stopover habitats for resting and refueling. So we actually have quite a few here in the Roaring Fork Valley.
So even though there were 1.2 billion birds, and that's the most that they've seen, the numbers are declining. Can we talk? Bird populations are declining.
Bird populations across the world, including in North America, are dramatically declining. So 2019, kind of a big revolutionary study that compiled about 100 years of data, discovered that today, in 2019, we had 2.9 billion fewer birds in 2019 than we had just 40 years ago. That downward trend has continued until now, 2025, so that approximately a third of our bird species in North America are dramatically declining. And that is across all habitats. That's in the forest, that's in the desert, that's even in wetlands. Across all species, across all habitats, birds are in serious decline. It should be a huge wake-up call for us. There's quite a bit that we can do to stop those declines. We don't have to continue on this trajectory.
Sorry to be stopping on that kind of sad note. We'll just have to have you back again to hear more about what we can actually be doing about the birds. They have a very complicated life cycle, and there's a lot of hazards on the way, and we're the big one, I think. We've been talking to Delia Malone. She's the co-chair of the Roaring Fork Audubon, wildlife chair for the Sierra Club, and a Carbondale resident. So great to have you here. Thank you, Delia.
Marilyn, you're so great. I love doing this. Thank you.
Thank you.